Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why do some key figures in American history seem to grow larger with the passing of the centuries, while others fade from our consciousness over time? Over the course of his own life in the 19th century, William Wells Brown was known variously as an author, a performer, a doctor, a fugitive slave with a price on his head, and an abolitionist luminary. He was well known to black and white Americans alike, as well as to friends and supporters abroad, who eventually raised the money that allowed him to buy his own life from the slaveholder who had claim to him. Today, though, despite publishing novels, essays, plays, memoirs, and travelogues, Brown's is not a widely familiar name, in part because of a long tradition of the whitewashing of American history, but perhaps also due to problems presented by the stories he told about himself. Ezra Greenspan joins us to talk more about this. He is Edmund J. and Louise W. Kahn, professor of English at Southern Methodist University, and author of a new biography called William Wells Brown, An African-American Life. Ezra, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
William Wells Brown is fascinating on a number of levels, in part because of his amazing gift for self-invention and also for reinvention.
Yes, his life was a continuous process of self and reinvention. He was born a slave. He grew up in slavery. He grew up illiterate. He escaped at the age of 19, had grown up in Kentucky and Missouri, escaped in Cincinnati from his master steamboat from the Ohio River, and ran northward on the so-called Underground Railroad. Wasn't an actual railroad, but he ran until he ran out of land. He planned to run to Canada, where slavery had already been outlawed. The lakes were frozen. It was December or January. And so he settled in Cleveland and began a new life, reinvented himself by name. He had been born with a single name of William. His master then stripped it of him when he was a child, renamed him Sandy. Brown despised the name. First thing he did when he ran away was to rename himself William Wells Brown.
Well, let me jump in there. Let's talk a little bit more about that name, because, you know, there are so many narratives of slavery, and you think about the violence and the indignity of being owned by another human being. The name issue really rankled with William Wells Brown in a way that I think personalizes slavery. He was called William by his mother, but then a child came into the family that owned him who had the name William, and so they said, well, there can't be two, so you have to have another name.
Right. The question is the most basic question. What is our name? Our name is our identity. And what we know is that he was given the name of William at birth, whether by his mother, just as likely by his master. He certainly wasn't called that. He would have been called Will, Willie, Bill, Billy, some colloquial version. And that was the name that he bonded to. But his master, who was also a relative, who was the first cousin of Brown's biological father — Brown's father was a white man — had adopted the son of a sister who had died in childbirth. And that son had the name of William, and at a certain point in the child's infancy, the master, whose name was John Young, decided two Williams was one too many for purpose of convenience, and so he stripped the future William Wells Brown of his birth name, renamed him Sandy. And so for Brown, the question of one's own name was basically a question of the right to one's own person. So it was personal for him in the most powerful way, but it also was a fairly representative problem in the history of African Americans in the South. Their names were not their own. Their bodies were not their own. Their lives were not their own.
This book obviously reminds us of the kinds of traumas that people had to overcome if they were just to simply survive slavery and then sort of go on and make lives for themselves. And I was thinking a lot about the research that we have today about resilience, right? And I was thinking that Brown's relationship with his mother, if anything in his early life was kind of a blessing, it was that for, you know, the early part of his life, he had this woman who not only doted on him when she was able to have contact with him, but cared very deeply for him and believed in him.
Yes, and it seems likely — the evidence is almost non-existent, but it seems likely from Brown's writings that He was a special child. He was one of seven children. We think he was the youngest, and we think he was probably also the favored child. In any event, Brown's relationship with his mother, it was basically the only bonded relation that he had that he would have considered legitimate. And so growing up under difficult conditions, his mother was his landmark. She was basically the one certainty in a totally uncertain life until eventually she was herself sold down the river when he was a teenager. And that certainly must have been part of the process of any adolescent in reinventing himself or herself, although this was actually before he had any prospect of escaping from slavery.
Before Brown was initially sort of hired out to other people to do work for them to earn money for his master, John Young, what kinds of jobs was he doing for Young?
He was probably doing anything that Young needed at the time. Young was a fairly prosperous farmer and an all-purpose employer of too many slaves for one household. He was living in St. Louis. Brown was for most of his adolescence. And Young apparently had too many slaves. This was fairly common for prosperous slave owners in St. Louis. So he rented them out, business opportunities, one to a ship, to a ship captain on the Mississippi River, another to a landlord at a hotel. And Brown wound up doing any of a number of minor jobs during his adolescence. The most important, though, we know, was his service on the first generation of Mississippi River steamboats. Brown would explore virtually the entire of the central emerging United States. This is in the 1820s and 30s, after the purchase of the Louisiana Territory, in effect, not only double the size of the United States, but open the prospect of the United States becoming a continental nation. And as the Mississippi River became a central artery, this adolescent working menial jobs on one steamboat after another was in effect exploring the United States in a way that very few Americans at that time could. Other jobs, he worked for the important newspaper editor Elijah Lovejoy, who years after Brown worked for him would become the first white martyr of the anti-slavery cause. He worked for hotel owners. He probably worked for Brown, for Young, doing all kinds of odd jobs on the family farm. And an important service, apparently, he also worked with Young was a very well-known practicing doctor in the St. Louis area. And Brown, apparently, probably because of his intelligence, was aiding Young in some menial capacity, preparing medicines, but probably also doing certain kinds of medical care for fellow slaves on the farm.
And it would seem that that experience was something that allowed him years later to practice himself, and I suppose he studied medicine in books and in other ways. But it speaks to the powers of observation that he must have had, which clearly served him well as a novelist.
Right, and this is jumping, in effect, 40 years ahead, but he would become a practicing doctor in Boston for 20 years, and apparently a very competent one. One of the cycles of reincarnation that Brown would go through over a period of years.
One of the steamboat jobs that William Wells Brown was forced to work at was on a ship that was trading slaves.
Virtually all the ships that were traveling on the Mississippi River going down to New Orleans were trading in slaves, or they were transporting slaves on behalf of slave masters up and down the Mississippi River. The American economy of that era, most especially of the middle parts of the United States and of the Deep South, were built on slave labor. So slaves were not only one of the major labor forces, as were free blacks on Mississippi River steamboats. I think the figure is one in three hands on a Mississippi River steamboat was an African American, and two-thirds of the African Americans were slaves. So they were the manpower and the woman power on the boats. But they also had the terrible task, in effect, of expediting the sale of their own people on the markets of the lower Mississippi River. One of the most amazing parts of Brown's experience, it must have been one of the most formative, was the year, an entire calendar year, in which his master, Dr. Young, rented him out. It was a kind of a mortgage, as it were, for the year probably 1832, to one of the most notorious slave traders on the Mississippi, a man named William Walker. And Brown spent an entire year helping Walker. They would go upcountry in Missouri gathering slaves, a kind of a hunting, gathering, and then selling expedition. And then when he had enough men, women, and children chained to one another in coffles, he would bring them to the edge of the Mississippi River, probably to the port of St. Louis, and then go down the river, that's where the expression comes from, and sell them at the major ports of Mississippi, and then eventually whoever was left at the final destination of New Orleans.
It's hard to imagine what it must have felt like to witness that day after day, month after month, realizing that, you know, any one of these families that was being ripped apart reminded you of your own family.
Absolutely. And the terrible tragedy of Brown's private life was that almost within 3 or 4 months after that year of what he called hell working for Walker, the year ended and Brown went back into service with Dr. Young. Brown's own mother and sister were sold by Young to another slave owner in St. Louis, and that person, for reasons that are not clear with respect to his sister, sold first the sister down the river, and then a few months later, Brown's own mother down the river. And Brown, who had been down the river on the boats, on the right side of the boat, as it were, must have gone through one of the most terrible traumas that an adolescent could possibly go through.
And at that point, even if you happen to know where they are, which in many cases people couldn't know, when people were not allowed to read and write, there would be no way to be in contact.
No, it was falling off the end of the earth. And it wasn't just a matter of not knowing to read or write, but these people basically were deliberately being taken to places from which there were no means of communication. Brown understood immediately when his sister was the first to be sold off, that was the end. He would never see her again.
So he was about 19 years old. It's New Year's Day. The steamboat that he's working on is docked in Cincinnati. What happens?
Right. His third master, Young, had sold him to another person in St. Louis, and that person in turn to a steamboat owner named Enoch Price, one of the legendary names of steamboat captains on the old Mississippi River. Price made it a very stupid mistake, a miscalculation. He took his family down to New Orleans for the Christmas holiday in 1833, and he decided to take Brown and a young woman, a slave, to whom he was hoping he could attach Brown, probably in order to have another generation of light-skinned, very intelligent slaves. And once in New Orleans, apparently, instead of going back to St. Louis as he originally planned, decided that he would go up the Mississippi River, take a right at Cairo, and head up the Ohio River to Cincinnati. Price was originally from Ohio. But before he did, as Brown tells the story, he had a very frank conversation with his slave boy, Sandy, just trying to get reassurance that Sandy would not take off once they landed in Cincinnati. And, of course, Brown reassured him that he just loved slavery. Slavery was wonderful. He was attached to the family. And the moment that they landed, New Year's Day, 1834, Brown took off.
We're speaking this hour with Ezra Greenspan. He's professor of English at SMU and author of the new biography, William Wells Brown, An African American Life. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Ezra Greenspan, who is Edmund J. and Louise W. Kahn Professor of English at Southern Methodist University and author of the new biography, William Wells Brown, An African American Life. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So it's New Year's Day, 1834. Brown escapes. He might have died of exposure to the elements, but he got lucky after a few days.
Well, he had, there's a Jewish saying of having good luck and bad luck. His bad luck was he hit one of the coldest weeks of the entire winter. We know that because there were press reports that the Ohio River was frozen all the way down to Cincinnati, and he was running north. But he apparently ran for a period of time, we don't know how long, but probably about halfway across Ohio, probably was not properly dressed, certainly wasn't used to the freezing north, probably ran out of food, and eventually starving, maybe suffering from frostbite, took his life in hand by exposing himself, waiting to find a passerby, hoping for the right good Samaritan. Ohio was a free state, supposedly, but in fact many Ohioans supported slavery and certainly wanted nothing to do with runaway fugitives. And he apparently allowed, this is according to his memoir, two white men to pass by, didn't trust either of them, saw a third elderly white man go by whose clothing he could judge was a Quaker. Quakers were widely known by and large as opponents of slavery. Best bet, Brown basically came out to the main road. And the person took one look at him and asked him if he was a runaway. Brown, realizing that he was taking his life in hand, admitted that he was. And this person, whose name was Wells Brown, took Brown back to his farm. He and his wife nourished Brown, housed him, gave him a little bit of money. And as Brown tells the story, it basically is playing on the story of the naming of Jacob by the angel of God. He fought him, as it were, although this was no fight, no contest. But Wells Brown offered to rename him as though he were, in effect, adopting his own son. Brown, as he tells the story, gladly accepted the name, but insisted that he be named not just Wells Brown, but have his birth name of William and the connection really to his own mother and to whatever heritage he could lay claim to as the first part. And as far as I can tell, from that point on, Brown would never allow anyone to call him by a nickname, by any name other than some formal version of W. Wells Brown in England or William Wells Brown in the United States.
There's such beauty and such potent symbolism to that story, which I gather is true. But when William Wells Brown wrote the story of his own life, there were times when, you know, you talk about him sort of referring to the story of Jacob in the Bible. There were times when he took the facts of his own life and sort of adjusted them to make for a better story in service to a larger truth. Is that accurate?
That is accurate, and that's basically what all great storytellers do, what all writers of fiction do. But in fact, it's also what great writers of nonfiction do. Writing, speaking is always an act of telling stories. Stories always involve invention, but invention doesn't necessarily mean fabrication in ways that make stories fundamentally untrue. This is especially an interesting matter for the future leading historian of African Americans in the middle decades of the 19th century, as African Americans began to have a culture of their own, a press of their own, a binding story, narrative of their own. And one of the great truths about Brown is that even as an historian, what he was trying to do was to create stories, biographies of the great African-American men and women of his generation, stories of their collective heritage, of their aspirations, stories that fundamentally told the truths of their lives. And sometimes Brown understood that in order to do that, with a minimum archive, with no prior histories or books to lead the way, one had to make stories. So storytelling was what Brown was all about. His life was always his greatest story, but his connection to the ongoing life story of his people was the great binding cord of his life.
So after William Wells Brown left Wells Brown and his wife, he immediately attached himself to the operations of the Underground Railroad. Can you tell us a little bit, Ezra, about how the Underground Railroad was organized at that time, how Brown found his way to them, and what he did?
Right. The dates are crucial. Brown escaped in 1834. That's very, very early in the history of the Underground Railroad and in the history of organized anti-slavery. Really, the great period of the anti-slavery movement is the 1840s and most especially the 1850s, as the issue of slavery became a more and more important and eventually the central issue in American politics. So Brown's escape took place relatively early in the process. The Underground Railroad was a largely improvisational, informal kind of activity, not a physical structure.
Right. And are there people, do you come up to undergrads who think that it was an actual physical structure?
Sorry, oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Many people believe that to this day. In fact, there are legends all across the states of the Underground Railroad, from Ohio all the way to New England, where every other person who lives out in the country would testify that his or her cabin, the parents' home, was a depot of the Underground Railroad. It's the stuff of legend, of course. And in Brown's case, it seems very likely. Brown was working on the steamboats on Lake Erie for most of the 1830s, which meant that he was in a position to aid fugitives to cross, as it were, the River Jordan from the slave. Even though the North was supposedly free, no one was absolutely – Brown himself was not – he was not legally free and not absolutely secure in the North. His master could send someone up at any time to reclaim him. And so Brown understood that being in the privileged position of working on Lake Erie steamboats, that he could help people to cross over into absolute freedom. And that's what he did. Apparently, he did it as an independent. He probably informally had connections with other African Americans working on the lakes. But it seems that what he did at that time, he did on his own initiative and certainly to his own danger.
So he has, you know, a day job, obviously, working on these ships that would give him access to do this. He's ferrying people to safety in Canada or farther north. How did he find time and where did he go to become this astonishing autodidact?
Don't know. That's a great question. How does anybody who is an extraordinary overachiever manage to do what he or she does? But a couple of presuppositions. Brown was obviously extraordinarily intelligent. He was extraordinarily dedicated, extraordinarily energetic. He had an extraordinarily retentive memory. So I suppose a combination of great talent, intelligence, and super dedication and ability. This was a person who, from early on, obviously, if Young was relying on him to do medical chores, Young probably had dozens of slaves on the farm. Brown was a young person who stood out from the earliest age. He was a person who figured out how to do things and to do them with extraordinary not just resolve, but efficacy.
Is there any evidence that Brown was paying attention to the written word when he was working for Dr. Young?
No. But in fact, we know virtually nothing other than what Brown would later write about what was happening on a daily basis in his life. We did discover that Young was a very well-educated man. He probably was educated. He was He was a doctor. He was probably educated at the first medical school in the new United States. He was certainly very bright. He had a library. We saw in his probate file the list of books in his library. And presumably Brown grew up in an atmosphere of cultivated people. If he served as a house servant, he surely did in the Young household. He was around well-educated people, visitors of that same class. He probably walked into, maybe he cleaned the books in Young's library. And so he was in an atmosphere of learning, but there isn't a single piece of evidence that Brown was functionally literate at the time that he ran away at the age of 19.
How did he begin to write, and how did that correspond to the time that he spent in Europe?
Well, I think, first of all, he became a writer ever long before he went to Europe. Mm-hmm. He published his first book, Narrative of William W. Brown, one of the great fugitive slave narratives, in 1847. My theory is that writers like Brown or Frederick Douglass and Henry Bibb, all of whom were great speakers, professional anti-slavery lecturers, and who actually made most of their living by giving nightly lectures, these were people who worked with language. They were masters of language, and what they were able to do oratorically, speaking, delivering powerful message-centered texts to live audiences, they learned to do with pen and paper. And so when Brown told the story of his life on paper, he was he was retelling a story that he had been telling to audiences probably for 4 or 5 years. That's how he became a writer.
When you read the text that he left behind, do you get the sense of the cadence of speech? Does it read aloud easily?
That's really an interesting question. Writers are always asked that question. People who know them ask or state, you know, I can hear you speaking. And especially for a person who made his living as a professional speaker, you know, you'd think that question is doubly significant. And maybe it's because I spent so much time with Brown that I hear Brown's voice just about everywhere I go. But in fact, one can hear some of the rhythms, some of the stories. And in fact, one can find in newspaper accounts of Brown from published earlier on. So certainly he was recycling stories that he had told. And the voice is distinctive. One can hear that very specific, sardonic, rhythmically balanced voice of William Wells Brown in journalistic accounts, repeating texts that he'd given orally 2 or 3 years before.
What kind of relationships did he form with other abolitionist figures of the day, notably people like William Lloyd Garrison and Frederick Douglass?
Well, everybody knew everybody. Mm-hmm. It was a small world, and not just that, but this was a small principled minority under attack from a very large majority. And so people were pressed together, as often happens in fringe groups. But there were very powerful fissures within the U.S. abolition movement and the world and the Anglo-American abolition movement. Brown worked primarily for the radical abolitionists of New England, led by William Lloyd Garrison. He and Garrison were lifelong friends. I think Brown considered Garrison one of his most special friends in the world, the person whose judgment he trusted, with whom he worked side by side for many, many years. His relationship with Douglass, this is one of the great relationships of the 19th century, and it's one of the most problematic. The arguably two greatest African-American public figures of the 19th century, Douglass, the most charismatic, the most eloquent public speaker in the African-American world, the most important political leader, a big, powerful man who sucked the oxygen out of any room he walked into. Eyes went up and focused on Frederick Douglass when he entered the room.
It seems like he had a kind of a movie star quality.
He had great charisma. All the reports about Douglass respond to that. And Brown also was a very impressive public figure, a wonderful public speaker, but Brown had a very different temperament. He was much less a dramatic speaker. He was much more a sophisticated, ironic counterpuncher. Douglas would lead with the right. Brown would counter with the left. And their positions within the politics of the anti-slavery movement also became fundamentally different. Douglas, who also had worked for Garrison in the early years, split with Garrison and adopted a more politically centered approach to solving the problem of slavery. Garrison believed that slavery would never be solved by political means. It could only be solved, as it were, evangelically by converting the great Protestant heart of America against the immoral, anti-Christian principles and practices of slavery. Douglas eventually came to the conclusion that that was nonsense, that that was really avoiding the most direct, effective way of dealing with slavery. Brown sided primarily with Garrison. That set him over and against Douglas. And given their temperamental differences, their political differences made for very, very complicated infighting for many years.
One thing that I was surprised to learn is that for a writer as prolific as William Wells Brown, there aren't a lot. I suppose there are no libraries. He left no written materials other than the things he published?
Basically, yes. There's no archive. And given that Brown was one of the best read African-American writers of the 19th century, he was the most widely published by far African-American writer of the 19th century, and because he based his writings deeply on the published writings of other people, we would presume that Brown had one of the greatest libraries and archives of any African-American of the 19th century. It is a huge loss that that archive is apparently gone.
We're speaking this hour with Ezra Greenspan, who is professor of English at SMU and author of a new biography called William Wells Brown, An African American Life. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to ask a question, you can join us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Ezra Greenspan of SMU about his new biography, William Wells Brown, An African American Life. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. So by necessity, we'll fast forward a bit here, but Brown goes to Europe. He intends to stay, what, about a year? And ended up having to prolong his stay because there was a major price on his head back in the States. But he did a lot of really important speaking and writing while he was, based in London.
He had an extraordinary 5 years in England. He went, the dates matter, 1849. He arrives in England, summer of 49. In the winter and spring of 1850, the U.S. Congress passes a series of laws, including the Fugitive Slave Act.
Meaning you couldn't live in a northern state as an escaped slave.
Well, if your name was William Wells Brown, you were an internationally known author, and your master had gotten copies of your earlier books, it was not a wise decision to go back home. So Brown put down roots. He brought his daughters over. He had two children, put them in school first in France, then in London. And during 5 years, he brought out one book after another. It was arguably the most important period of literary and cultural productivity of any African American, I believe, of the 19th century. And he made his primary living, just as he had in the U.S., going from city to city, speaking publicly. He was the best-known African-American or black public speaker in the British Isles during those 5 years. He was a very, very well-known writer and speaker.
Tell us about his novel, Clotel, which was not only just an interesting work on its face, but an incredibly courageous thing to publish in that time. It was a fictionalized account of the stories that existed even then of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings.
Right. It's a preposterously interesting novel. We know it today as the earliest African-American novel. In some sense, Brown was looking in the mirror as he told the story, the fictionalized story, of Thomas Jefferson's biological slave daughter, a young woman named Clotel. The rumors about Jefferson had been going around across the South and then across the abolitionist movement by the 1840s. Brown certainly believed them, and he would have believed them for the most obvious reason, because Clotel, in a manner of speaking, was a sister. So the story was an attempt to retell the story of America by taking on the founding myth of Thomas Jefferson. But what most intrigued Brown, I think it is the great contradiction of the United States. Brown had it right that Thomas Jefferson was the author of those great resounding words, principles that we all believe in about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that all men are created equal. And he was also the biological father, in a manner of speaking, of the perpetuation of human slavery. So Brown, playing with that, told a kind of epic anti-slavery story of what happened to the children of Thomas Jefferson as they, like Brown's own family, were sold deeper and deeper into the deep South of the United States, and riffed on that with all kinds of stories, drawing on jokes and anecdotes and tall tales that were circulating across the United States, pulling a lot of this out of printed literature, sometimes reusing it without a single change, sometimes refurbishing it, putting a little accent where an accent hadn't previously been, but altogether producing a rip-roaring anti-slavery narrative about the truth of life in the United States and the fundamental contradiction between American principle and American practice. And curiously, a book written in London and published in the 19th century only in England. It would not be reprinted, at least not in the United States in its original form, until 1969.
So talk about the audience that it had in England. I mean, surely people who were interested in the cause of American abolitionism would have chosen it. Did it find a general audience as well, people who simply were looking for a book to read? Was that not the way people in the mid-19th century chose their books?
Right. It's hard to answer. There's no archival evidence. What we do have are formal printed reviews. But it seems likely that the book would have reached primarily people in England who were already anti-slavery oriented. It would have had, in other words, a kind of a large but a niche audience. And this was the audience that Brown had, of course, been cultivating for 4 years in publishing other works and giving lectures across the UK. But it certainly was not a highly popular text. He'd actually published two books earlier in Great Britain that would have sold much more widely than Clotel. But one of the great things about Brown was that he could never finish a book. Many writers are like this. But with Clotel, he would bring the story of Clotel back with him to the United States the following year and retell it, revise it, and republish it three more times in different formats between 1860 and 1867, which is to say, to retell it in the revolutionary, transformative times between the run-up to the Civil War itself, and the beginning of Reconstruction.
How was he influenced by his encounters with people like Victor Hugo and Charles Dickens and the sort of European literary figures that he came in contact with?
Probably marginally. Mm-hmm. I think that Brown liked mixing for a person who's coming out of slavery and illiteracy to have social relations with people like Hugo and Dickens was to feel legitimated. But I think culturally speaking, they had very little to say to Brown.
Mm-hmm.
I think Brown probably would have thought that he actually had more to say to them.
Objectively speaking, apart from, if you can do this, apart from the historic value of the kind of work that he was doing, how does he hold up as a writer, purely on technical merit?
Well, this is a great question.
Artistic merit.
A writer whose works were eclipsed for over a century now is a writer who's taught in every major American institution of higher learning. He's taught across the UK. Clotel is now part of the American canon of serious literature. His works resonate. They reverberate. And not only because they are, for many people, politically correct today, but because they're extraordinarily rich and inventive. He was a great, great storyteller. And his facility with language, with settings, with critiques of the most powerful myths in our society are so powerful that it seems to me pretty clear that he is one of our most important writers, again, after a century lapse.
It would ultimately cost $300 for him to effectively buy control of his own life from the person who legally, at least, had claim to it. Where did he get that money?
This was a great ethical dilemma, and Brown would respond to your question that he never did that. Abolitionists and fugitive slaves called it paying blood money. It legitimated the practice of slavery. And so the principle was that somebody like Brown would not purchase his or her own freedom, but rather Brown, in his case, allowed good friends in England, a Quaker family named Richardson, ironically the same family that purchased the freedom of Frederick Douglass a decade earlier, to fundraise and make possible the purchase of Brown's freedom papers. Brown would have said that he had no role in the enterprise.
Hmm. What did his life look like when he returned to the United States to live permanently?
He came back in 1854 to one of the most reactionary periods in the history of slavery. Slavery intensified, the fight in Congress intensified, and he immediately, it was as though he, after 5 years, he was right back to day one in hitting the abolitionist circuit. And he returned to active lecturing. He began writing plays in the late 1850s, these wonderful anti-slavery plays. The text of only one has survived, but it's one of the most important American plays of the 19th century. He didn't simply write it. Being Brown, he performed it. He would go around night after night in the cities across the northern tier of states, reciting in a one-man performance all the roles in the play and turn it into a kind of spectacle in which he was attempting to persuade a public which might not have been easily persuaded that black people had the right to freedom, that slavery was an abomination. And that was the next round of his public service. So a kind of a combination of public speaking and public performing that would take him really right up to the years of the Civil War.
I was interested in, I guess, some of the performances that he gave were sort of high tech for the day, and they utilized kind of a slideshow, which at the time would have been like a draw on its own, and then maybe people would also come to hear him and be persuaded.
Right. We call him a writer, but he was actually a multimedia performer. He wrote primarily in print, but he also, we know that he was a great speaker, so the voice, delivering the message orally was a central component of his work. But he also had a profound instinctive sense of the power of media and what was new in the world of media. We think of Aris as the age of media, but in fact, mass media were already one of the most powerful developments of the 19th century. And Brown would use any medium, any means of making the argument about the necessity of the abolition of slavery. And so during some of his lectures in Great Britain, he adopted the latest technology, which was basically an early form of slideshows. He would have an artist create a picture that could then be prepared as a slide and presented, because there were no light bulbs during that period. They would use very powerful candlelight, and he would project images onto screens as a way of visually and orally present mixed media messaging his case. He also put together, which is to say, he had London artists construct huge narrative drawings into what were known as moving panoramas. This is really an early stage, a forerunner of motion pictures that were very, very popular in Victorian England and in mid-century America. Narrative canvases that might be 200, 500, 1,000 yards in length, put on scrolls and unrolled stage by stage as a narrator would tell the story. In Brown's case, he was telling the story of American slavery. This was another of the media that he adopted during the 1850s.
Are any of those panoramas extant today?
Actually, there is one panel of one of them that you can see at the Amon Carter Museum. I think if you get there in the next 3 weeks, these moving panoramas in the United States were centered, for complicated reasons, in St. Louis, Brown's hometown, and they often pictured the scenery of the Mississippi River, the heartland of America of the 19th century. And there is one of these panoramas that survived in the St. Louis Museum of Art that is currently on loan here in Dallas.
For people who haven't read Brown, is there a first text that you would point them to? Is it Clotel?
I would say, actually, the life story is so interesting. The most accessible text would be his first book, Narrative of William W. Brown. And then from there, jump to Clotel.
Ezra Greenspan is Edmund J. and Louise W. Kahn, professor of English at Southern Methodist University. His new biography is called William Wells Brown, An African American Life. Ezra, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help today from Christina Martinez. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.